if you wanted to catch Sydney's attention, all you had to mention was Ireland. And if you added fish onto that, he was captain. He loved Ireland, had been coming there from the time he was a young adult. If he came there to Lochfern in 1924, 1925, and I know he used to come in around Easter time for a week in all those early years, and kept doing so, going to Lochfern right up into the 1960s.
Hello and welcome to the Ireland on the Fly podcast about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland. This week's episode is another book club one with returning author Dan O'Donovan, whom we spoke to previously about his book, The Salmon of the River Lee. Dan has also written a very popular monograph on Sidney Spencer, who was a renowned angler and author on loch fishing for salmon and sea trout in the northwest of Ireland and the Western Isles of Scotland. And we speak to Dan about Sidney Spencer's life and legacy and his love of fly fishing in Ireland. But Tom, before we hear from Dan, it's as good a time as any, I suppose, to remind people about our first Ireland on the Fly Masterclass, which is taking place in about a week's time via Zoom on Thursday, 14th of March at 8 p.m.
Yeah, good man, Tara. Yeah, really looking forward to this. Yeah, we've been planning this for quite a while, both you and I, and it's come to fruition now next weekend. Delighted. It's great to get Mike on board, because like anytime Mike's been on before, as we know, like there's always a fair bit of interest in it. And I think the subject that he's on about buzzer fishing, buzzer and nymph fishing, there's still a bit of an air of mystique about it. I don't want a mystery. It's a method of fishing that people get a bit sort of up in a heap about, because I don't know, it's whether it's confidence or knowledge of what to do. Like, it is definitely the one I get asked the most at whenever I'm about at a show or a fair or anything, when I'm talking to people in the public. So I think it's really good to get this one to start us off in, and I think no better man to get the mic. I just put a thing up there this week with his CV. Just mention it there. Facebook page.
Tell us a bit about Mike's background.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like, he's I know Mike now. I've fished with Mike for 25 years or more, and like, he's pretty good angler. But like, the CV shows that he's fished, represented Ireland over 10 times in international competitions. One of the best ones was when he captained the Irish team in 2018 on the home international Loch Mask. And that just went like clockwork for them. And they won that by the biggest margin ever by an Irish team.
Wow.
Which was really impressive. Really impressive. A couple of things there as well. He's won the top Irish rod. Won that in Rutland. And I mentioned there in the piece I put up, like, I mean, that was on a really windy day. And he was straight lining nymphs, doublebacks, and he did really well in it. And one other fairly prominent English angler said to him that day, that evening, because he was watching him, he was in another boat, he says, one of the best displays of nymph fishing he'd ever seen.
Wow.
And that was on Rutland water, in on an English water. So yeah, no, he's really, really come to the fore with buzzer fishing. Like, he's good all over. Like, he won the World Cup on Loch Mask 2010, and he won that on wet flies. So, you know, he's fairly accomplished all around. So yeah, no, look, he's good, really good buddy of mine. Anybody who knows me knows I fish a lot with Mike. I've learned a hell of a lot off him, but I've been lucky to be in the boat with him.
And hopefully as well, there's been huge demand actually and interest in that. So it just shows you, A, people are interested in the topic, and I'm sure they want to hear what Mike Keady has to say. People will get access to the video recording. And if you can't make it on the night, you'll have access to it. And you'll also have access to Mike's notes as well, his presentation. So, you know, you'll come away with whatever, you know, from the night. You'll also come away with information to, I suppose, glean and learn more from. And don't forget as well as the Q&A.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say that's important.
Yeah, so any question that pops up or you've had a question in mind, this is the chance you can actually ask Mike yourself and say, Mike, what about this? And he will answer it as well. So I think it's the running order for the night will be myself and yourself, Tom. We'll be chatting to Mike. We'll let Mike do his presentation. Then we'll come back as well with a few questions and then open it to the floor as well. So I'm looking forward to it. It's good crack.
Yeah,
and one of the reasons, I suppose, why do this is it's one of the most kind of what people are asking for is that kind of how-to information. We're not going to do those kind of episodes every week because it would just be boring, it'd be dry. There's so much more to Irish fly fishing in terms of the culture, the history, the people. But this is a great way for, I suppose, for the demand, for the interest that's there, that if you want to learn from it, from some of the best people in the business at this, this is a great opportunity to do it. So we'll see how we get on. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll go very well. And judging by the interest as well, there's a lot of people interested.
Yeah, I think it will too. I think it will there.
Great. For people wanting to know anyway, the link is in the show notes for this episode. You can also go to www.irelandonthefly.com/masterclass. So look, let's get back to this week's guest. And I first asked Dan O'Donovan to tell us more about Sidney Spencer's life and background.
Well, Sidney Spencer was an Englishman born in Bury in 1902. We know his dad did a little bit of fishing. His dad had a business in Bury, which failed in 1905. And some short time after that, the family moved to Belfast in Northern Ireland. And if you analyse what Sidney says about his life in all of the 7 books he wrote, you'll be pretty sure he started his fishing in Belfast at the age of 6. And the little rivers in that part of Antrim. The family moved a few years later. By 1910, they were in what is now known as Bear's Den, a suburb of Glasgow, and there was fishing there. And Sidney was an avid angler for a very young age. Eventually, he became, when he grew up, he was bright at school, etc. He became a commercial traveller. In those early years, I don't know what he was a commercial traveller at, but he started writing magazine articles, maybe late 20s, certainly through the 30s. He wrote in lots of books, Fishing Gazette, Shooting Times, Yorkshire Post, and others that their names aren't just coming to me now. Quite interesting articles, some of them. And he became friendly, it seems, with Marsden of the Fishing Gazette, not the original R.B. Marsden, but his son who was involved in the Fishing Gazette then. And he put some of his articles into books. The first book was about fishing for salmon on lakes, and that came out in 1934. And quite surprisingly, you wouldn't get any hint it's a young fellow writing that book. Right. There's great knowledge there. You read it and you know this guy knows what he's at. If I could be so bold as to suggest, you read some books today and you know, the guys, they haven't caught a whole lot of fish. You know, it becomes pretty obvious. But you reckon,
Dan, that somebody could be bluffing?
There's always an odd fella.
They do podcasts these days now, Dan. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. That fella there is able to fish all right, Darry.
Just talking about Tom there, just in case you're wondering.
So, In the mid-30s, he wrote 3 books. That first book was followed by a book, Clearwater Trout Fishing with Worm, which is a particular kind of fishing that was done around the Scottish borders and the north of England. It's basically a rod about 12 feet with a fly line and a few feet of a cast, and they're fishing worm upstream. And it's all, as I understand it, even though I've never practiced it, it's all about stealth and your approach. And there's you need to be well able to master the method before you start to catch trout. And it's only used in low water. It's not worm fishing in high water. Very often summer and that. And they fish that for brown trout and sea trout. Apparently not so much now, but it was a big deal in those days. So you're fishing upstream with a little pennel tackle or something like that, or a steward tackle. So the minute that that you felt the bite, you were pulling against the fish. So that was quite popular. And then the following year, 1935, he brought out a book about pike on the plug. Now, the big thing to note about that was that it was revolutionary thinking at the time, because up to then, anyone fishing for pike, he'd have a big pole of a green heart rod or a cane rod and heavy tackle. And if you caught a small jack pike, 4 or 5 pounds weight, there wasn't a whole lot of sport in it. So Spencer brought in rods from America, typically steel rods, very light, single-handed casting rods, and fishing with much, much lighter tackle and plugs up on top of the water, so that the takes were more visual and a bit more sport and excitement on it. And he wrote a book about that, which was it was very well received and very highly regarded at the time. There's actually a writer by the name of Barry Rickards who wrote something about a book about pike, and he names the 10 greatest pike anglers in that. Now, that book, I think, came out in the 90s, and Spencer makes the list because of his innovation. Now, the short rods, the 5 foot rods, didn't bear the test of time, but lighter tackle did. So you can see from those three early books, he was hugely a thinking angler. And if Spencer had something to say, you'd listen. And you'd find very little to disagree with. Where he really made his name was in the late 60s and early 70s. I didn't find any articles written by him after about 1941. And his business life, he was in sales and marketing. He advanced from the commercial traveling, and he sat on the boards of a number of companies. So he was a fairly serious operator and lived a very good lifestyle. And he had some health issues in the early 60s, around 1963, and he took early retirement. And in the late 60s, he resumed his writing on angling, and he wrote 4 marvelous books. The first in 1968, Salmon and Sea Trout in Wild Places, followed in 69 by Newly from the Sea, and in 72, Ways of Fishing, and in 74, his last book, Game Fishing Tactics. Now, they're anecdotal in their general style, but there are lots of specific comments on difficulties that the loch angler in particular might have. Now, Spencer fished very much for salmon and sea trout. I would imagine that was his first love. He wrote most about that. He also fished in rivers. He fished in, when he, after he left London, which I think was mid-1940s, might be slightly before that, but he moved to Somerset. So he was within 50 miles of the River Taw and the River Mole, and he took a beat there somewhere around 1946 and kept it for 20 years. Even though he was, he travelled up to London to Letchford, I think was where his office was. He travelled up and down for the bones of not quite 20 years, but up against it, typically on a Sunday or a Monday morning, coming back down on a Thursday evening. So that gave him the weekends to fish there. And he did a lot of fishing for nighttime sea trout fishing, salmon fishing in the spring. So those books made him famous for the second time. And then in 1991, Jeremy Lucas, Tom, you may have come across him on the international fishing scene. Jeremy has written a number of books himself, publishers of writing an anthology of Spencer's writing. And he has a little bit of background stuff there about Spencer, not in huge detail because he couldn't find out a whole lot about him, especially when Spencer had passed away in 1977. So how did I find out about Spencer? I tell the story, I think, in the preface to the book. back in, I think it was August 1992, myself and her who must be loved and cherished, we were on a week's holidays touring around the west of Ireland. We got to Westport one evening and we were booked into our hotel and that, and had a wander around the town. And we were going back to the hotel and Bernie wanted to go in to get some magazine or whatever it was. And I was there standing as you do, dutifully. And the next thing, in this newsagents, I spotted an angling book. I'd say the only angling book in the shop. And it was Jeremy Lucas's anthology of, and it's called Fishing the Wilder Shores. And I picked this up, and as I do when I pick up a book, I glance through it, read a paragraph here, read a paragraph there. And I said, yeah, I kind of like this style. And I bought the book. Went back to the hotel anyway, and I lay down on the bed. Herself was getting changed before we go out and that. And I'm a couple of chapters into this, and I'm saying, where was this guy all my life? Lessons that I had to learn the hard way below and Killarney and Waterville and Loch Carran about sea trout and salmon fishing on the lochs. It was just pouring off of the pages, and I could find nothing that was wrong, you know. So for anyone who wanted to learn about loch fishing for salmon and sea trout, it's all there and in a lovely style, lovely writing. And he's not dictating to you in his writing, telling you to do this, do that. And what I found as well with his writing, you'd read his books and you get caught up in the reading of the book and you read a way through it. But where its real value is when you come back and reread the book and take your time.
Yes.
And you might think I'm a nerd altogether. I see a nod in your head there, Tom. I actually...
No, I'm agreeing with you going over the second time.
Because the second time, when
you, it's very true what you say, because sometimes somebody's writing style, and as soon as you said Sidney Spencer, I thought of Nedgely Farson. When I read Nedgely Farson, it's like I'm in his world, right? And I just breeze through it, and it's absolutely wonderful. And I had to go back and read it again because I sort of lost myself in the moment of enjoying his writing without really
exactly
taking things in. And I won't say that it wasn't that I'd lost attention. I just loved the writing so much. It was just so easy. And when you said that there with Sidney Spencer, I'd go, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
So is his writing then that magical mix of how to whilst also being very well written with anecdotes as well? So it's that combination.
Yeah. And he will describe days in a boat. And what you like, I'm sure many of your listeners will have fished with various strange partners in boats, and we've all got into a boat with some fella, didn't know his head from his arse, and you know, you wouldn't be just comfortable with the way it was going down the drift and that.
For those of us who can't see now, I'm laughing a lot here.
Yeah, well, I hope you're not laughing at me when you'll be going down Duras there, Tom.
No. You're describing the experience as perfect.
But he in his books, he will describe why and how he's going down a drift and how to approach a drift. And he talks a bit about the Hebridean style. Now, here in Ireland, you'll see two guys in a boat. And if there's a gilly, the gilly is in the middle on the oar. The Hebridean style is smaller boats, typically 16, 17 feet. A man on the oars and a man sitting on a plank fishing off the stern of the boat. And he will control you going down the drift as you fish. So you can cover the water. And when you're coming to lies, he'll hold you off the lies. A good gilly won't dare let you drift over the lies because salmon, and I think particularly fresh sea trout, are easily moved off of lies. So he'll advise, say, and now when Spencer did his fishing in the Hebrides, he fished above on Lewis and Harris, and they were private lakes that he was, from what I can establish, he was invited to fish by a friend. So he'd have maybe the lake to himself for the day. But he fished public water in Ireland, especially in Lough Esk and Donegal and Loch Fearn before that. And he talks about things like saving the best water where the best lies are until the right fishing time of the day. So, for example, what am I talking about here? If he goes out in the morning in the month of March and it's cold and frosty or whatever, the day hasn't warmed up, get your arm in, maybe not on the best lies, and maybe when the day starts to heat up about 11 o'clock, you can start fishing the favoured water then. Now, that mightn't work in a place where there's 10 boats on the lake and some fella will rush in, but you can see he's working the head all the time. You can learn from his books. Now, look, he talks about tackle and that too, tackle has changed hugely since Spencer's day. But I would contend that how you fish and how you use the tackle hasn't changed at all. Certainly, I don't believe the fish have changed. And their lies might change from time to time. The other thing that comes across from reading Spencer's books is that he gave a huge amount of thought to fishing problems. Say if you and I go out on a day, Tom, and we've a calm day and a light breeze and the sun is beating down on top of us, we might tend to drift aimlessly along, or we might put the thinking caps on and say, right, where are we going to find a corner here now where we can fish a dry and there'll be a few fly coming off or whatever. Spencer is very much into that, thinking his way through fishing problems, how to tackle rising lochs, very high lochs that have risen from a huge flood in the night, which very often tends to put fish off. Comes up with a lot of stuff like salmon and sea trout on a day with a huge gale blowing from a certain point fairly continuously, that the fish will shift their lies. He contends that they move downwind. Salmon certainly, not so much sea trout, but certainly salmon. So you get the wind then the following day. You might have been out a couple of days before and you're finding fish on a west shore someplace, and you're out the next day and you go straight back to the west shore and you can't move a fish there. And the argument may be that the salmon have moved. So you get lots of stuff like that in his books, and you can take it or leave it, but you have to back that up against the man who was consumed by fishing from the time he started at 6 years of age until the time he died in 1977 at 75 years of age. He actually died, the poor man. He lived in Devon at that stage, and he had a bit of a heart condition. And that January, he'd had a pacemaker fitted, and I'd imagine a pacemaker fitted back in 1970, whatever it was, 77, wouldn't be maybe as smooth an operation as it is today. But anyway, himself and his wife, Gladys, they drove from Devon to Wales, got a ferry over to Cork, and were driving up to Loch Esk and Donegal, and the wife was doing all the driving, and with about a half an hour to go, Sydney insisted on taking over the driving, and a short while later, he had a bit of an episode on a straight stretch of road, crashed into a parked car, and he died the following morning in hospital. He had a heart attack. So that was the end of Spencer.
And where was he? Did his wife, was he buried back in England? Was there any kind of commemoration where he died up in Donegal, anything like that?
There was, actually. Interesting you say that. He'd been going to fish Loch Esk since about 1934 at Loch Esk. He'd been going to Loch Fearn since about 1924, 1925. He was a very regular visitor to Ireland. And I couldn't really understand why, but his mother's maiden name was Hanley. Now, Hanley is a Roscommon name. Now, she was born in England, but I wondered as well, when his father's business went broke in 1905, why did they move to Belfast? I would have thought that a little strange. So perhaps there was an Irish connection. There's no knowledge of that Irish connection in the family, but they do. I do know, having spoken, I managed to find Sydney's niece, Sandra, who was a lovely person. And she told me that if you wanted to catch Sydney's attention, all you had to mention was Ireland, and immediately, and if you added fish onto that, he was captain. He loved Ireland, had been coming there from the time he was a young adult. Like, if he came there in 90 to Lochfern in 1924, 1925, he was 22, 23 years of age. And I know he used to come in around Easter time for a week in all those early years, and kept doing so, going to Lochfern right up into the 1960s. And that was a mammoth job of travel in those days. And mostly he used to go by boat and train, you know, so you'd lose a lot of your time traveling from London all the way to, I won't say the wilds of Donegal, they mightn't appreciate a comment up there, but it was a hell of a journey in the mid-1920s. And I actually knocked across an article in the sometime in the 1933, I think it was, a comment in the paper that Mr. Sidney Spencer, along with a man by the name of Latham, were going to Lochfern for a week's spring salmon fishing. And the comment said they were going to travel by car. So an adventurous journey in 1933. I couldn't find any follow-up article to say how they had got on.
And in your trawl of all of that, did you ever come across any articles he would have written about fishing in Lochfern that he might have written for the Fishing Gazette or anything?
No, I didn't. But in his books, and this is part of the charm of his books, he doesn't mention most of the places, the lochs where he fished, or when he's fishing a river, he doesn't name the beat. And I was intrigued to know where was the bugger fishing. And he does, one of the few lochs he mentions is Lochfern. And he gives very accurate descriptions, physical descriptions of the waters that he fished. And say, if he was fishing around Douras now, Tom, you'd know every stone along the road because he would describe it. So he never mentions Loch Esk. He doesn't mention that name in any of his books, but he writes more about Loch Esk than any other loch. He writes quite a bit about Lochfern. Lochfern is rather unique in that the inflowing river and the outflowing river Lennon at Lochfern, they both come in at the same narrow end of the lake, and they're only maybe a couple of hundred yards apart, and there's a whole huge bank of reeds there. And it's, if he's talking about reeds and an inflowing and outflowing river, you pretty quickly realize it's Lochfern. So you can track these things down. Also, the gillies that he fished with. Now, he didn't always use their correct names, and he never mentions a surname. He might say John or Pat or Patsy or whatever, but he'll throw an odd queer one in there, that, and the guy doesn't exist at all. But when I started to write the biography of Spencer, and quite a bit of the book is about the places that he fished. I tried also to trace the lochs, and you know, I could get most of them now. I don't reveal them all in the book, but I give enough of hints if someone is really interested, and if he has Spencer's books, and if he follows the hints that I've given, you'll track down most of them. And one of the ways of doing that is the gillies, because while the angler might roam around, the gillie doesn't roam around quite as much. So if you see him talking about Michael, you'll know he's fishing for the, you can be pretty certain he's on Loch Esk. The same with the gillies that he mentioned when he's not fishing in Ireland. Most of what he writes about is fishing that attached to the Morsgale estate, Hamana Bay estate, and the Amansui estate in Lewis and Harris. And it's very interesting to read about the runs. It saddens me really when you read about some of the runs of sea trout there, and indeed the runs of the salmon. when you we know what has happened because of man's interference, be it salmon farms or environmental interference or damage on the high seas, whatever. But when you see the numbers of fish that he describes, now his book isn't all about big happy catches and bagfuls. He'll write about the bad days and the days of the black dog and things when nothing goes right. But all the time he's looking for the lesson. I'm sure you'll know, Tom, being a lockman, much more so maybe than Dara, you'll always see in the competition there are certain guys will pull a fish out of the bag. No matter what the conditions, they'll always get one. And Spencer is one of those guys. And the good guys, they come through consistently in the catches. That's probably pretty obvious. Now, how do I know that Spencer wasn't spoofing? I was lucky enough through a man who had he was one of the owners of the Hamanavay estate in Lewis up to, you know, I'm not sure, is it Lewis or Harris? Actually, it was Lewis, I think, a number of years ago. And he had a copy of the Marsgale records at the times when Spencer was there. And I was able to go through those. Now, they're handwritten records. And I can tell you, the writing isn't easy. And if the owner of the estate was there, who at the time was a man called John Foster Robinson, Robertson, you could read the writing pretty well. But if it was Spencer writing, it was impossible. His writing was appalling. But I could compare the different anglers who were there fishing with how Spencer was doing. And his results were really, really consistent. Really consistent. The only person who would have kind of measured up to him when they were there at the same time was that man Robertson. He was a very good angler as well, and consistently great catches.
So when you discovered the book in the newsagents, and you know, obviously devoured it, and you obviously went out then and looked for his other books, what led you to want to write about him?
I didn't want to write about him. I had no intention of writing a book about him, but I wanted to find out about him. So the early noughties, myself and Bernie, we went to Donegal for a week, and I wanted to fish some of the places he'd fished. We went and we fished at Loch Fearn, caught a few brown trout. It was August time. We didn't see any salmon. I certainly didn't catch any. We went to Glenloch, and we went to Loch Esk, and I inquired here and there. I won't say I went to exhaustive efforts, but anyone I met, I asked and inquired, and I came up with practically nothing. One guy was able to tell me the name of his gilly, and they were long deceased. But it was by accident that I started to research him deeply a few years ago. It was during the first lockdown in COVID, and I'm one of these immunocompromised people, due to an arthritis condition. And I was basically locked inside on the advice of my doctor inside the four walls of the house because we didn't know how this dangerous thing this thing was going to become. So I was just went to my books there behind me one day, and I was reaching for a book, and I saw one of Spencer's titles out of the corner of my eye. I said, must read that. So I pulled it out and I read it a couple of days later. And I said, you know, I've lots of time in my hand now, and the internet is there now. And I didn't have great access to the internet. And I was busy doing the day job back in the early noughties and the 90s. And I said, time in my hands now, and I'm not going anyplace soon with this COVID business. Let's see what I can do. So the first thing I did was I did the forensic trawl of his seven books and took out all the personal items, notes about the gillies and what I could glean from them. And I found when I could cross-reference those from one book to another, they might be 40 years apart, but I was able to add to the picture. Then I started contacting acquaintances. The first man I spoke to, I'd say, was Paul Morgan. And as it happened, he knew a chap, Dave Burnett, who became the managing director of Witherby's when the firm he worked for bought it from one of the surviving Witherby brothers. Now, the Witherby's were the publishers for Falkes and for Spencer. And disappointingly, Dave Burnett told me that he had been an admirer of Spencer's writing. And when he got to the firm, he went and read the file. But he said there was very, very little there, certainly no personal information or that. So I basically just went through my phone contacting people. And I was lucky, you know, you get referred to one person here, found a few small little references on the internet, found a blog kind of thing on the internet that there was a good bit of stuff on, not all of it accurate, but some of it accurate. But I had a great stroke of luck. I decided one day I should send an email to the museum in Devon, near where Spencer lived. And this chap came back to me and told me he was a volunteer, a retired man, a volunteer working for the museum. And they'd passed my request on any knowledge of this man, told him I was trying to research his background and that. And I still hadn't thought about writing a book at this stage, but he said, you know what you should do? Write a letter to the Midweek Herald. It's a weekly newspaper for East Devon and West Somerset. Not Somerset. I can't think of the county next door. I sent that away, that email away. It was Bank Holiday Monday, middle of the day. And the following Wednesday, I was working away on something else. My phone rang, and I just absentmindedly didn't pay any attention, but saw it was a UK number, and I answered it. And this answer came down the phone. Hello, I'm Sandra Spencer. I've heard about your letter to the paper. And I was flummoxed because I had an inkling that Spencer had no children, and he didn't have. But this was his niece. And Spencer had a brother, Eric, who was a fisherman. And Eric died from lung cancer when he was 40 years of age. So that was about 1949. And he left two kids, Sandra, who was about three, and an older brother. And 5 years later, their mother died from cancer. So they were orphaned at a young age, and the kids were separated, and they went to the mother's family, to each to an aunt. Sandra had a very rough time, but her one highlight of her young life was when she was permitted to go to Devon for 2 weeks holidays to Sydney and his wife, Gladys. And she said to me, we were fed properly and we were loved. And that said an awful lot about the kind of upbringing she had in the house she was. But she was able to give me a lot of personal background about Sydney and Gladys. And, you know, tell me things that his favorite tipple was a glass of Jameson. He incessantly smoked Rotman cigarettes, which I'm sure didn't do much for his health. But practically every photograph you'll see of Spencer, this Rotman cigarette is hanging out the left-hand side of his mouth. So when Sandra was 16, she was told one morning back in London by her aunt, pack your bags, I've had you long enough. And she was taken to the train station and packed off to Devon, where she was met by Sydney and Gladys, who took her in. Now, Sandra never knew what happened behind the scenes, but I have no doubt that she was extracted from that situation by Sydney and Gladys. So I suppose that shows what a decent person that Sydney was, and also his wife, Gladys. Interestingly, too, the few people that I managed to meet who knew Spencer and had met him, and there were a few in Donegal, they all spoke very fondly of him. And there was, when he died, he died in hospital. Gladys, his wife, was also in hospital at the same time, and she wasn't able to go to the funeral. But Sidney was very friendly with a man by the name of Scott Swan, who owned a property at Loch Ness Castle. And it was there that Sidney kept the caravan for right through the 60s anyway. And he saw to the formalities of the funeral, and he went to Gladys in hospital. And she said, look, he was always happiest in Donegal. I think we should bury him there. And he is buried in Donegal. Is it the Glebe Cemetery? I've been there, and I was able to do a little video clip and send it to Sandra in Devon, which meant a lot for her to see. But while Gladys wasn't able to go to the funeral, Scott rang around Sydney's pals, and I believe there was a great turnout of local country people at his funeral. That man, Scott Swan, he lived to be a big age, but he's long dead now. He kept the diary, and he records how great a turnout there was at the funeral in the diary, and that he had a whole load of list of people that he had to pass on condolences from. So when Gladys Spencer got out of hospital, she was taken to Loch Esk to recuperate for a couple of weeks. Some relations had come from the UK, a nephew and niece of hers, and an old friend of Sydney's had come as well as soon as they heard he passed away. And they stayed for a couple of weeks, and Gladys went back to the UK, but she returned some months later to settle up affairs and all the rest of it, I presume, pay bills and such like. And at that stage, Scott Swan bought whatever quantity of tackle was there in Donegal off of Mrs. Spencer. And I was very interested to see that tackle, because it was held by John Swan, Scott's son. And he knew Spencer well as too. He spoke very fondly of him. He said they always looked forward to their visit. He said Sidney and his dad would often be in the house at night, or, you know, having a drink or a cup of tea or whatever they might have, and they'd be chatting and digressing and laughing long into the night. But what I was particularly anxious to see were the fly boxes, and there's a dozen of them. Now, Spencer writes quite a lot about flies. His favorite salmon pattern was a Dusty Miller, not the traditional pattern with a guinea fowl hackle, but one with what he called the pinky flame hackle. And there are a number of those in those boxes. It's a kind of an orange hackle. Now, unfortunately, Spencer did not tie flies himself, so he was relying on others to tie flies. Nothing extraordinary in the patterns there. Clearly, all his boxes aren't there, because there's patterns that he does refer to in his books that aren't in the collection that remains. I also heard afterwards that Gladys Spencer died within a couple of years of Sydney. She contracted cancer, and there was nobody in fishing in the family. And Gladys's nephew and niece, they apparently burned any amount of tackle and fly boxes in the back garden within a fortnight of she passing away. The other great tragedy was Sidney's diaries. He kept the diary from his mid-teens up until the end of his life. And while it would have been heartbreaking to try and read his bloody terrible writing, it would have given us an extent of the scope of where he fished. Now, he fished widely. In the 50s and 60s, I know he went to Sweden and Norway fishing. He wrote a little bit about Norway, but not in huge depth. But there are hints in his other books about fishing in Wales, both brown trout fishing in Anglesey, and sewan fishing, or sea trout fishing, as we might call it. And some of the articles that he wrote make it pretty clear that he fished all over Ireland. There's a reference in one of his stories to catching trout on the River Mag in County Limerick. He refers elsewhere to getting flies in from a man named Killarney, and that's probably either Courtney or McCarthy. I also knocked across a reference to an article about brown trout fishing on the River Blackwater. So while I could never establish what he did in the line of commercial travelling, it wouldn't surprise me at all, and this is only a speculation on my behalf, if he was a traveller for a tackle company.
Be the ideal job for him.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly took his tackle all over. I even wondered at one stage, he said quite so much about Wales in different books, I wondered if he lived in Wales. But his niece Sandra had no knowledge of he ever living there.
Tell us, Dan, the reputation of Sidney, was he a lot more well known in the UK because of his writings there than he would have been in Ireland?
He was very well known here too, because, okay, you know, if you look at loch fishing and salmon and sea trout fishing in the lochs, there are very few books, and Niall Fallon's book, I suppose when did that come out? The 1980s, I'd imagine. He refers to Spencer in that. Now, he restricts himself in that to mostly Irish writers, but he refers to Spencer and others, yeah, who wrote about Ireland. Spencer said late in his life that he considered himself almost a Donegal man. And he spent so much time here in his latter years that he was berigged about his Irish accent that he'd acquired. Now, he'd smoked so much cigarettes and drank a good share of whiskey in his time that he spoke with a rough, grumbly voice. And late in his life, he grew a little small beard. And the family said that was another reflection of his increasing Irishness.
It was definitely a spiritual home, wasn't it? Like, you know, and even the fact that he's buried up there, you know, just shows it. Yeah. Where was Gladys buried?
She's in Bradford, I think, in the UK. I have it in the book now. So the
husband, fascinating that she wasn't buried with him.
Yeah, and that she was glad for him. She was happy for him to be buried there. Like. Mm.
Yeah, well, I don't think they were deeply religious. That's the impression I got from speaking with Sandra. That's not to say they weren't believers of a type, but I didn't delve too deeply into the religious side of it when I was exploring. Better off sticking to fishing matters.
Adopting E.J. Malone's principle there, yeah?
Yes, exactly. Interesting. A little aside I thought of there. I mentioned Falkus a while ago, and you mentioned Nedgely Farson. I don't know if you know, Tom, Nedgely Farson apparently became very friendly with Henry Williamson, who wrote Tarka the Otter. They lived together quite closely. Now, they were two very volatile characters, especially Williamson. Well, both of them. Farson had a serious problem with the booze, by all accounts. And in some of his non-fishing books, I've read one or two of them, it comes across very strongly. And Williamson and himself, they fell out at some stage. That was a frequent enough occurrence, but they had quite a serious falling out at one stage. But thereafter, Farson referred to Henry Williamson as Tarka the Rotter. Now, Witherby's were also the publishers of Hugh Falkus, his book on salmon, his books on salmon and sea trout. And the sea trout book he was revising at some stage in the, I think, the very early 70s. And I think it was Fred Buller got the job of bringing Falkus and Spencer together. Now, Fred Buller was a regular visitor to Ireland, and Spencer and Falkus met and fished together for a couple of days in the company of Buller. And I don't think they got on too well. And Tony Witherby, the man in charge of Witherby's at the time, asked Spencer, what did he think of Falkus? And the reply he got was, the man is an incompetent as a lock fisher. Full stop.
Right. Whoa.
But having said that, in reference to a list of fishing books in one of his own books, across various aspects of game angling, Spencer did say that for sea trout, river fishing, you couldn't pass by Falkus.
So, like, I suppose in that sense, then, there, you know, if you want to learn all about locks and sea trout and salmon, Sidney Spencer is your man.
I would say so. And if you wanted me to give a recommendation, if someone wants to put their toe in the water with Spencer, my recommendation would be to track down a secondhand copy of Fishing the Wilder Shores by Jeremy Lucas. Mm. You'll get it online. And you'll find, if you Google Sidney Spencer, his books will pop up all over the place. Paul Morgan will have a stock of them. They're expensive enough. You know, you can pay 60, 70 euros for a lot of Spencer's books. You'd probably pay less for Jeremy Lucas's one, but it is a terrific anthology, and he's made a very good selection there.
Let's not forget, Dan, your own one.
Yeah.
Well, Sidney Spencer, Fisher of Wild Places.
Sidney Spencer, Fisher of Wild Places. And you asked me at what stage did I want to write a book on Spencer. I mentioned contacting Paul Morgan initially, and maybe 5 or 6 weeks later, I had a phone call from Paul one day, and he said, Dan, how are you getting along with your research on Spencer? And I updated him, and he said, do you think there's a book on it? And I said, only, I said, if I can find a bit more on the family, if I can track somebody down. And he rang me again a couple of months later, and at that stage I had a good bit more established, and he said, look, he said, if you think there's a book in it, he said, I'll publish it for you in his monograph series. And really, I should make the point, there's lots of us anglers, but few enough of them are book readers. And this little Spencer monograph I've done, there's only 250 copies of that in a kind of a paperback type form, and a very small number of high quality and expensive quarter bound leather hardbacks. But I have to compliment Paul on the fact that he bothers to publish these at all, because there's no money in it for him. You know, these are expensive to produce. You know, they have to get a designer and a printer, et cetera, et cetera. You'll know much more about that kind of business, Dara, than I would. But not just mine, but a whole range of other books that he's published. And I'm very grateful that he has done so. Not just for my book, but for others that he's published that I'd be interested in. So if anyone is interested in those, they'll find him. If you Google Cocky Bandu Books or
Anglebooks.com, yeah. Exactly. And yeah. Dan's book is there, as well as the other monograph series. And like you said, the hardback version is there as well.
Just like to say, I think, because I've been reading it, and it's a fantastic piece of investigative work that you've done, Pat. It really is. You've done so much work to get. Yeah, it really is. It's really impressive.
You can only recommend it. You can be lucky, Tom, and I was very lucky with a number of people. And, you know, when I was researching my book, Salmon of the River Lee, I found when you went to people and told them what you were about and they saw you were genuine, you know, total strangers.
Doors open.
It's amazing how far out of their way some people would go to help you. But for those people, there would be no book. And the level of detail, like I had people in Donegal knocking on doors, trying to track down long dead gillies and all this type of thing. And then in the finish to turn up Spencer's tackle, there's photographs of that in the book. That was great. And that's all down to the generosity and benevolence of individuals.
Definitely. Have you any other books on the horizon, Dan? Are you any plans? Are you too busy fishing?
I'm too busy fishing and having a good life.
surely there's something in the pipeline. Surely.
No. I was asked to become involved in something a couple of years ago, and I was going to be drawn into it. It was more on the research side of it. But that board didn't fly anyway. But not to worry. People should realize writing is a pain in the arse, especially when you're when like I wanted to research Spencer for my personal interest, not for writing a book that was secondary and came later in the day, but the amount of effort into it. There's 12 months of solid work to produce that little book. And it for me, it was a labor of love. And the people who've read the book and have emailed the publishers and, you know, they'd send on their comments, they're very gratifying. We spoke about my book, Salmon of the River Lee. That was another labor of love. But that was 2.5 years of backbreaking work, really, to put it all together. So if anyone thinks that it's a dawdle, oh, give me fishing anytime, or give me cutting bushes on the riverbank.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, no, it has to be. I mean, you guys have to know it. I mean, you Dan, and you particular, Dara, as well. I mean, like, I've only ever done articles, and I mean, articles kill me. You know, like, so what goes into a book?
People forget as well, especially when you're going down the publishing route, like with the big publishing houses, they're very exacting. Like the copy editors, I mean, every comma, every word is examined. Yeah. And is that in the right place? Should be that be there? And the amount of edits you go through, it, you know, you're nearly sick of it, like at that stage. But when you see it, you know yourself, Dan, when you see it in its finished cover, and they send you out the box of books and you pick them out. I'll still never forget it, the very first book I ever wrote. And you open up your box of books. There's something very special. And actually, I have to say, this is very funny. You go into a bookshop, and if your book is there, every author does this, right? You find your book and you'll put it front and center, right? And you'll be doing this, right? But I saw an interview with Michael Lewis, you know, the world famous nonfiction writer, you know, The Big Short, Moneyball, all that kind of stuff, Going Infinite. And he was being interviewed by the BBC, and they went into this little bookshop in Washington, D.C. And this guy's one of the biggest selling nonfiction writers in the world. And what does he do when he finds his book? Takes it out and puts it front and center. So I was like, even Michael Lewis does it. Don't feel so bad. So listen, Dan, it's been brilliant chatting to you again. It's been wonderful finding out about Sidney Spencer. As you said, for people who are interested, you know, have a look at the Jeremy Lucas anthology, but we couldn't recommend enough as well your own one, Sidney Spencer, Fisher of Wild Places. It's on anglebooks.com for anyone that's interested. Dan, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our thanks to Dan O'Donovan for joining us on the show. Don't forget to rate, review and follow the Ireland on the Fly podcast on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Plus, you can keep up to date on IrelandOnTheFly.com as well as on Instagram. And myself and Tom will be back with another episode about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland.